Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Economics for Rebels, the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Not too long ago, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered. This rebellion continues. This is a podcast dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations. Conversations with and for those who are ready to act on rapid and radical change for people and planet. Welcome to our podcast. I am your host, Alexander Kovesh, and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. No doubt that ecological economics is about inducing radical change in the world. While that is almost never up for debate in these circles, just how radical is radical remains to be a highly divisive issue. Environmentalist movements had been seen in the past rather peaceful, and being rebellious as an ecological economist is more about strongly attacking the current order in theory. But can profound change really happen without blowing up a pipeline? Today's guest, Andreas Malm, argues that it cannot. Andreas is a climate activist, author, and associate professor of human ecology at Lund University, Sweden. In his work, he often argues that those vested interests in the current world order will not just turn green out of kindness of the heart. Movements that induced radical change in power structures in the past, such as feminism or the anti-apartheid rebels, only achieved their aims when they turned away from just symbolic moves. In his latest book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, Learning to Fight in a World on Fire, he argues that ecological movements remain unsuccessful as they only consider peaceful means to achieve radical change. Welcome, Andreas.
Thank you so much, Alexandra.
Let's start with probably the most rebellious thought that has appeared on Economics for Rebels so far. You claim that environmental movements can only be successful if they do not shy away from attacking private property. Why do you argue that?
I have to perhaps temper the claim a little bit and say that it's not that I know for a certainty that the only thing that will work and that it actually will work and give the desired effect is property destruction on a massive scale. Rather, what I'm arguing is that the time has come for the climate movement and its allies to consider this as the potential next step and to diversify our tactical repertoire and to escalate and to do something more than what we've done so far. And I think the case for this is pretty strong, and we don't really need any advanced conceptual maps or historical analogies or sophisticated understanding of political tactics to be drawn to this conclusion. Rather, it's the state of state of affairs of this planet that pushes us in this direction. And this state of affairs is worsening year after year. And, you know, what's going on right now on the fossil fuel front is just mind-boggling with the extraordinary windfall profits streaming into the coffers of companies like Saudi Aramco or ExxonMobil or Total or Shell and BP, thanks to the high oil and gas prices that preceded the Ukraine war. You have a situation where these companies are drowning in profits and are, of course, reinvesting them in more fossil fuel extraction. This is what all these companies are doing right now. And this goes, again, of course, directly contrary to what the climate scientists are saying, most recently in the IPCC report just released, and the experience of extremely rapid global heating, such as the recent heat waves in the poles. So while climate is breaking down faster and faster, the big oil and gas companies and coal companies, for that matter as well, are rushing to transport as many new fuels to the fire as they can. And this situation is completely out of control. There is nothing that governments have done so far that has reined in this destruction to even the slightest degree. And this, of course, also reflects back on the climate movement, because it means that what we've done so far clearly hasn't been sufficient. So there is generally, I think, a sense in the climate movement that we need to step up. And I don't claim any credit for this whatsoever. It's in the logic of the events themselves. But you see now campaigns like Just Stop Oil in the UK, where you have a kind of more offensive targeting, offensive in a strategic sense, and blockades of refineries and terminals and other points of distribution of fossil fuels in the English or British infrastructure, or you see the spread of campaigns to deflate SUV tires in the UK, and now it's come to Switzerland just this past night. It's been growing in Germany. In Canada, there was an instance of extremely militant attack on a pipeline construction site in the Wet'suwet'en territory, the Coastal GasLink, that's been the object of intense contestation in Canada over the past years. This happened in late February when activists stormed the construction sites, chased away the guards, and used the equipment that they could find to destroy as much machinery as they could and caused major financial damage for that pipeline constructor. And there was widespread talk in British Columbia among politicians that this would cause a chill on investment in fossil fuels. And it's exactly that chill that we need to establish, a deterrent against these companies from continuing to destroy the planet. And I do think that property destruction and sabotage have a role to play in establishing that pressure that governments have so conspicuously failed to establish so far.
You said we don't need any historical insights to understand that. But nonetheless, I wouldn't mind you talking about some of these historical insights, because in your book, Fossil Capital, you argue that coal and oil fueling the climate crisis was not an inevitable technological development, but it was just in the interest of a few white, mainly British men. And basically, we need to go back to the steam engines if you want to understand climate change.
Sure.
Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't say that to denigrate the importance of historical research. I'm a history nerd, and most of my research is environmental history. So, and currently, my mind is somewhere in around the year 800, Common Era Europe. So, I'm all for historical debates, of course. Yeah, I mean, the point of the investigation that I published as Fossil Capital was to criticize this idea that fossil fuels and climate change have been produced by humanity as a whole, and that it's somehow more or less natural aspect of the human enterprise or something like that. And going back to the moment when fossil fuels became deeply entrenched in the first industrial economy in Britain, you can quite easily see that this doesn't really conform to the facts. Fossil fuels, and more particularly coal, and more particularly still steam power, as the sort of technological complex that really deeply produced a fossil fuel base or material substratum for the modern economy, didn't come about as a result of any democratic deliberation or playing out of innate human proclivities or anything like that, but came about because steam power served the power interests of capital in its conflict with labor. It was a much more amenable source of energy for surplus value production than what the traditional energy source, water power, was in the end, even though steam was actually more expensive in terms of, you know, the unit of energy that you could extract from water and steam was considerably cheaper from water, but steam had other respects. And there's a strange, not exact, but nonetheless a sort of reflection or analogy to the current situation. The price of renewables across the board is dropping extremely fast. But for the big private energy providers, this is a disincentive to invest into renewables. Brett Christophers, an incredibly sharp geographer at Uppsala University, has showed this recently in a very important paper, and he's apparently turning this into a book, that the economics of the transition is counterintuitive in the sense that high prices for oil and gas are an inducement for big private energy providers such as Total or Shell or BP or ExxonMobil, who claim to have a portfolio of renewable energy and going more in that direction. But the more the discrepancy, the divergence increases between the prices, the more compulsive it becomes for them to, or the more compelling it becomes for them to keep investing in fossil fuels, because that's where the big profits are for them. Renewables are becoming so cheap that the rate of profit that you can get out of renewables pale in comparison with the profits that you can get from expensive oil and gas. So we have here the perverse situation where for humanity as a whole, it would even be financially beneficial to make a total shift away from fossil fuels to solar and wind, in the sense that you would not only save the climate, but you would save money from making this transition. But for private corporations that make the key decisions, and of course that this goes for state corporations as well, such as Saudi Aramco, it works exactly the other way around, that the major profits are to be made from what you can have a high price out of.
Now we've been talking about, well, mainly private companies kind of turning towards renewables. But the situation in the Ukraine is now moving states to move towards renewables at a faster pace than before. Do you not
think? Is it really?
It's something to be seen, obviously. But what's your hypothesis?
Well, to be honest, I'm not, for various reasons, fully up to date with these developments. But what I've seen are very mixed signals, as in, for instance, the Tory government in the UK planning to substitute for imported Russian oil and gas by increasing extraction rates in the North Sea. Or Germany, you know, going on a building spree for LNG terminals to replace Russian gas with gas sourced from elsewhere, be it Qatar or the US or some other place. And there is a pressure on other fossil fuel producers to step up to replace Russia. So this seems to me like an opportunity to move away from fossil fuels that is in the danger of being lost. That what the key decision makers are doing is to replace Russian oil and gas to some extent. I mean, there is still a lot of dependence on those sources, obviously, with other sources of fossil fuels rather than with renewables. And this is, in a sense, a bit similar to the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, which was also a golden opportunity to initiate the transition and have a green build back and all of these things. And that opportunity was totally lost and wasted. And instead, you had so much stimulus money poured into fossil fuel sources and companies. And I think that the lesson here is that those opportunities that emerge in times of crisis, be it a pandemic or a war or perhaps something else in the future, will be lost if there isn't a subject, a popular agent, a movement, a mass force of some kind that can establish the pressure on governments to take the necessary steps. There is no rationality in our governments, in advanced capitalist countries, that would impel them to take the necessary steps of their own accord, of their own volition. Otherwise, they would have done so long ago and used these crises as the opportunities that they have been. But I don't see that happening so far. To the contrary, I just see the trends continuing in the wrong directions. I mean, last year, 2021, as the International Energy Authority just reported, we saw the largest spike, the largest increase in absolute CO2 emissions in recorded human history. I mean, how insane is that? That in 2021, after, 6 IPCC reports, 26 COPs, all the suffering playing out among the most affected peoples and areas, you have the largest increase in total CO2 emissions in a year ever. That just shows you that there's no rationality in the system. It's completely irrational. And the only way to rein it in is to build some kind of counterforce from outside of state apparatuses. That's the only conclusion I can draw.
Okay, so basically we have established, and I obviously tend to agree with you, that within the logic of capitalism, we will not be able to overthrow fossil fuel in time. But then comes the question that to overthrow capitalism, you probably need a wider base of supporters. It won't happen just, you know, by a few environmentalists trying to do that. But the fear here is that if you go more radical, this would actually alienate the wider public rather than make them realize that, okay, what we've been told and the promise of the reform of capitalism is wrong. I mean, I live in Hungary and we just re-elected Orbán for the simple reason that he's got the most simplistic messages.
Sure.
And to make people realize why capitalism is contradictory to our safety and long-term success on this planet is a hugely complicated issue. So how would you handle this contradiction that you can't really appeal to the wider public through more radicality?
Yeah, there are many different questions here at stake, or issues at stake. First of all, I'm not saying that the solution is to all of a sudden, from one year to the other, dismantle capitalism and get rid of world capitalism. And only then can we solve this. I mean, that would be totally illusory, because some of us on the left have been trying to abolish capitalism for a couple of centuries, and it's been a very difficult task, and it's not something that we're likely to accomplish in the time frame we're given to address this problem. So it would be to put the cart before the horse to say that we have to start by getting rid of capitalism. That might be the end point of a process that begins with establishing public social control over fossil fuel production. And that, I think, requires, in all the cases where you have private property in fossil fuels, socialization, expropriation of companies like ExxonMobil, Total, Shell, and all of these things. And where you already have state ownership, you can order these corporations to do something differently. Now, that is in the nature of what we would call, in my political tradition, a transitional demand. So, for instance, if you look at France, where you have a presidential election in just a few days, the largest private corporation in the country is Total, which is one of the most aggressive companies when it comes to pushing the frontiers of fossil fuel extraction right now, including building what will be the world's longest heated crude oil pipeline in East Africa. This company has no reason to exist as a fossil fuel company. It should cease to exist tomorrow. And the only conceivable way of doing that would be for the state to take it over and sequester it and order it to do something different. Now, that's not on the political agenda in France at all. Macron is not going to do it. Le Pen is not going to do it. Possibly Mélenchon would consider it, but apparently his chances are not that high, unfortunately. I don't know if he's ever thought about it. But anyway, if you would start doing something like that, taking over the single largest private company in an advanced capitalist country as France, you would start to push against the barriers of the capitalist status quo, and you would set in motion a process that would potentially lead to a kind of economic and political rupture in a country like France that would possibly take that country beyond at least the sort of capitalism that we have known in that country so far. So this is how I think about the transition. You need a specific material demands that speak to the needs of the present moment. And these demands, by the very nature of the moment, have to be radical. That means that they have to clash with dominant class interests, as in we actually have to take over this company and make sure that it desists from further destruction of this planet. And when you have that clash, you have a political dynamic that you need to pursue and see where it leads. And I think there is a potential to get mass support for demands like this, even to frame it pretty simplistically, as in no more fossil fuels or just stop oil, as this campaign is saying right now in the UK, which is a very simple demand and should speak to quite a lot of people that are afraid of the climate crisis that is already impacting their lives in quite a few places, even in Europe. I mean, I just remember the past summer with the lethal flooding that happened in Germany. And yeah, I mean, no end to the climate disasters last summer. Of course, this is going to happen again in the next summer and the summer after that. And it's going to get worse. And the worse it gets, you would have to hope at least that there is a modicum of rationality and existence in reality among ordinary people that would make them prone to support radical measures. It just requires that you have people out there who call for these measures and who try to sell that message to the people by in word and in deed. I'm not saying, of course, that we should apply some kind of Orban populism here and go for, you know, just speaking to people's base emotions. But I don't think that it would be impossible to make a winning case for radical climate politics, given how afraid people are and how upset they are about injustices in our societies.
What you're talking about is politics. Yeah. And you were actually saying that there's nobody with a real chance in France to do anything about Total. So how to establish this political base? That's mm-hmm. the question.
That's a big question. Yes.
And basically what you're saying is that we need to be a lot more visible. And by visible, I mean, may not only involve peaceful means, to make people realize that this kind of politics is badly needed.
Yeah, I mean, in the Total case, I've long been mystified by the absence of militant action against that company. There have been some initiatives, but on a very limited scale, precisely because France isn't a country that is foreign to quite radical forms of protest. To the contrary, it's the country in Western Europe that has the most vibrant tradition of that kind of contestation on the streets, with the cycles of protest erupting quite regularly. Now, how would you build a campaign against Total in France? What would be the sort of social basis for that? Well, I can see a few different reasons for people to get involved in a struggle like that. One would be that they have the knowledge of the climate crisis. One would be that they have the experience of climate impacts. And of course, such experiences exist even in France, that suffers quite bad heat waves. And thirdly, you can imagine that people want to act out of solidarity with people in other countries who are suffering. I mean, these are all factors that you would expect will increase in importance as we go ahead. And they have a sort of trans-class character, in the sense that virtually anyone in France would be amenable to any of these three factors. But I would suspect that it would have a strong generational gradient, as in much of Global North, that is, that it's primarily young people who know about the crisis and feel, you know, freak out about that knowledge because it concerns their future. And young people generally are more inclined to act on these things. But you could also conceive of a sort of class dimension to this. And there have been in France initiatives among Total workers in refineries and elsewhere, and calls from them to convert production and do something different with their installations than further wrecking the planet. And I'm sympathetic to ideas of this kind. For instance, there's a very important book coming out by my comrade Matt Huber called Climate Change as Class War: Building Socialism in a Warming World, I think is the subtitle, which argues very forcefully for trade unions to be seen as key agents in the transition. Now, this is not an entirely new idea. It's something that has been around for quite a long time, and it hasn't really caught off so far, because trade unions in the Global North tend to be sclerotic and weak, and in my country, Sweden, extremely bureaucratic, and generally in Sweden, totally indifferent to the climate issue. But there is a potential there, and I think in a country such as France, where you have a reasonably alive tradition of working class politics, which is not the case in many other countries in Europe, you could envision a sort of class component to a movement of that kind. As we go deeper into the climate crisis, and this is really the one thing that we know, that we're going deeper into the crisis, the impacts would be worse and worse and worse. There's no other way that we can see the near future. I do think that it's almost inevitable that you will see more radical kinds of actions, more popular worry. But of course, there's no guarantee that these worries, or these actions for that matter, take on a rational character. I mean, it could just as well provide fodder for the far right in all sorts of weird and irrational ways. Obviously, irrationalities exist outside of the capitalist class. We are prone to them, all of us. And because society as a whole is so fundamentally irrational, all sorts of irrationalities are multiplying and seeping down and amplifying each other. So I don't know if you're aware of this, but I wrote a book together with the Zetkin Collective called White Skin, Black Fuel, on the danger of fossil fascism, where we're looking into the response of the far right to the climate crisis. And actually, there's a bit of research on Hungary there as well, because we had a Hungarian member of the collective at that point. And we, you know, sort of juggle with different scenarios of how the climate crisis, as it's exacerbated, can actually serve the far right rather than what would seem to be more rational responses to the crisis. So there are no guarantees here. It's a matter of political struggle and of intervention and of trying to make a difference in how these things play out as we go ahead.
The slogan of the degrowth movement is decolonizing the imaginary.
Yeah.
This kind of shows that we are facing thoughts and ethics and belief systems that have been there for a long time and basically colonize the imaginary of the widest base of people. So when these movements come in and do something radical, do you not think they meet moral arguments that are going to just alienate the cause, rather than, because their morality comes from a highly distinct perspective than the morality you're talking about? So this is a kind of clash, and I don't see how this really can be successful. So without changing the morality or making people understand that the morality they believe in is actually destructive to them and to others, but those can only be done through peaceful means.
Yeah, so, I mean, to begin with, I think that there is a segment of the population in every country that is lost to the cause of climate justice. And what I mean by that is that you cannot expect to win everyone over. And clearly it isn't the case that if you're just kind and gentle and polite in your way of protesting, you will get everyone over to your side, because that's precisely what we've been for the past 2 or 3 decades. And we certainly haven't won everyone over. If we escalate and diversify into things like more disruptive blockades or sabotage or property destruction, we're not going to win these people over either. We're going to face a backlash from them, and they're going to lash out against us and tarnish us with bad names and whatever. But what you do if you start something like that is that you apply actual material pressure on the powers that be, or whatever you want to call them, vested interests, the ruling class, to change their ways, or else they will suffer some sort of consequences. So it's not just, you know, asking for a change in policy, but it's to establish a kind of a, how should I put it, an economic sanction or price, or a material cost for continuing with business as usual. It's going to have to hurt the pockets of companies to keep wrecking the planet, or is there have to be some sort of political costs for governments that just continue as if nothing is going on this planet. So the rationale for diversifying into more radical tactics wouldn't necessarily be to win over people like Orban or climate deniers. I mean, we have a very big far-right party in Sweden here, which is as crazily climate denialist as the Republicans or the AfD in Germany or elsewhere. I mean, you don't escalate to win these people over to your side. You escalate to start a process of trying to force the enemy, if you like, fossil capital or however you define it, to back down. And this means, to begin with, to stop investing in more production of fossil fuels.
This will sound strange, but at the end of an episode, I ask all my guests the same question. What is your rebellion? And in your case, this has a little additional spice to it. So what is your rebellion? And would you blow up a pipeline?
Well, to begin with, if I had concrete plans for blowing up a pipeline, I wouldn't tell anyone that I had such plans, nor in principle, nor in detail. But of course, it would be totally hypocritical of me to advocate for measures or tactics, forms of action that I wouldn't personally be prepared to engage in. But it is the case that, you know, what you do as an individual is sort of constrained by where you are in life and what channels you have, what affinity groups or political communities that you have. And if I found myself in circumstances where I could do truly militant things, I wouldn't hesitate. But my personal life is a little bit, how should I put it, not entirely conducive to that form of action for reasons I don't need to go into. But yeah, so in principle, would I blow up a pipeline? Well, yeah, in principle, I would be happy, very happy to get engaged in any kind of action of the sort that I lay out in my book, and I draw on some personal experiences. Actions of that kind need to be designed collectively in activist communities, and you need to be very careful about what you're doing and think about it, think through what you're doing together with others. And in my case, particularly after the outbreak of the pandemic, with all the isolation that it entailed and the sort of at least temporary collapse of the radical climate movement in Europe, I don't find myself in those circumstances, unfortunately.
You mentioned that you have a few personal examples. So, you know, this podcast being Economics for Rebels, can you tell us a few...
I draw on some cases where I've been to climate camps and the Gelände camps and things that we did there, such as, I think it was in 2016, we destroyed some fences and stormed a power plant in Lausitz. I draw on a campaign we had in Sweden back in 2007, where we deflated SUV tires on a pretty massive scale. These are low-key forms of property destruction or sabotage, as in destroying fences or, you know, inserting a little stone into an SUV tire so that the air seeps out. Maybe some people would consider it criminal damage, but it's of a very peaceful kind. Yeah. I don't boast about having blown up pipelines because I never did that. So I can't draw on any personal experiences of that sort, but I would be open to them in the future, given the right circumstances, yeah.
Has the SUV action had an impact?
It did in 2007. SUV sales in Sweden in 2007 dropped quite significantly. I don't remember the exact figure. It's in the book. And we interpret it as at least partly an effect of our campaign, which caught a lot of media attention and coincided with a general spike in climate concern. I think you remember 2007 with, you know, the IPCC getting the Nobel Peace Prize and the Al Gore film having come out the year before and stuff like that. It was a moment of intense climate discussion in countries like Sweden. And that type of sabotage is quite promising because it's so extremely easy to do. I mean, it's child's play to deflate SUV tires. Anyone can do it. You don't need any sort of advanced institution or leadership or command structure. You just go out in the dark in pairs and put leaflets on the on the cars so that the owner is aware of what's happened, and then you deflate those tires. And that's what people are discovering right now in Europe, that it's a very easy thing to do. And if you do that massively, I mean, if it just takes off and reaches a sort of critical mass, then clearly it will establish a kind of a disincentive to car consumers to keep buying these gas-guzzling killer vehicles. So if it can just proliferate, spread enough, surely it has the potential to change things.
Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for spending time with us. Stay tuned with us for our next episode.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.